The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We have lots to get to on this Monday morning or Monday afternoon, depending upon where you're listening in from. Here in a minute we'll get the rapid reaction to Germany's failure to bring together a four-party coalition. Richard Palmer is in the studio with us here today, and he'll be giving us the rundown here in just a few moments. Also, coming up later on the program, we're going to have another Winston Churchill movie review. We've had about five, six, seven of these this year. We need to even change the name of the program to incorporate our frequent reviews of Churchill movies. So we'll have a chat about that here in just a little bit as well. And then more seriously, we'll be getting into a study for the final segment on today's program, looking in particular at the great opportunity that God gave to Saul, King Saul of the Old Testament. There's a quote early on in my father's booklet, The Former Prophets, that that speaks about just how much we need to learn from these in some cases, spiritual warriors like Joshua and Samuel and David, and also see how others like Saul, how they failed even after they were given such a tremendous opportunity. So we'll get into that, as I say, during the final segment. Well, as I said there at the top, negotiations to form Germany's next government, they fell apart yesterday as the four parties hoping to form the so-called Jamaica Coalition failed to come together. They had a number of disputes, but some of the headlines here from the Telegraph: Angela Merkel's leadership in the balance as German coalition talks collapse. That's the operative word, it seems, from some of these headlines. AFP says German coalition talks trip over immigration stumbling block. Over at Reuters, it says Merkel fourth term in doubt as the German coalition talks fail. And then at the New York Times, German government talks collapse. Next move is unclear. Now, if you've been listening to this program, or especially if you've been following all that we've had to say at thetrumpet.com, and in particular over the last year and a half, I mean, you know probably what we're going to be discussing here in just a bit. But first, it's important to stress, as we've stressed before, that this is a huge deal. It's a huge deal. It's easy in the United States to just think that, oh, well, the politics of division, one side against the other, that's normal. That's the status quo. You see it in the U.S. You see it in the U.K. even. Gridlock, it's sometimes called. But that's not the way that it's been since World War II. Not the way that it's been in Germany. Brad McDonald, in an article a year ago, Germany, Political Crisis and Superman was the title. And he goes through a lot of statistics early on in that piece about how that if you look at the United States since 1982, we've had six presidents. Britain's had six prime ministers. Italy's had 15 prime ministers. But then if you look back at Germany's history since the end of World War II, I mean, this is going back to 1945. Germany's had only nine chancellors. And of course, with Miss Merkel, she's been in office, I think, 12, 13 years. Politico said, and this is quoted in Richard's piece, by the way, it's up at thetrumpet.com right now, but Politico wrote that news of the talks' failure is bound to unnerve many in a political culture that prizes stability. That's what they prize in politics in Germany, stability. Let me just give you one quote before I bring Richard in on it. This is from that article last year by Brad McDonald. And he says here, talking about a time in Germany when the politics or the government was very much unstable, he says the Weimar Republic, That's the democratic state of Germany between 1919 and 1933 was plagued by instability and disorder and was, in general, deeply unpopular. Extremist parties thrived, it says, while the Weimar government was constantly under threat of collapse. There were 14 national elections in 14 years. It says here, by 1933, the Weimar system was so enfeebled and there was so much systemic instability that the regime didn't stand a chance against Adolf Hitler and National Socialism. It says, finally, 7 years after he exploited the political and social crises to take control of Germany, Hitler and the Nazi Party lit the world on fire. So make sure that you go back to thetrumpet.com today and check out that article from Brad McDonald from, I didn't write down the exact date, but it's more than a year ago, Germany, Political Crisis, and Superman. All right. Well, we have Richard in the studio here with us today, and he, we've just posted a Trumpet article at the website, German Coalition Talks Collapse. And Richard, maybe what we can do is just have you explain a little bit about the discussion that's been going on since the elections and why they broke down.
Sure. So you've had the Jamaican coalition, these parties. You had Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union alongside the Christian Social Union was the largest bloc within parliament, but she didn't have enough to form a coalition. Now, she could have formed a coalition with the Social Democrats. The Social Democrats said no way. They didn't want to work with her. They'd just been in coalition with her, and then they went into the election and got their worst result since World War II. So they said that they wouldn't work with her. This, then she wouldn't work with the more extreme parties. So this really left just one option for forming a government, this Jamaica coalition. And it's one that nobody's, I think, really... I've seen a lot of people surprised that this collapsed, but nobody's really surprised that this was a tough negotiation to put together. You had, obviously, those two Christian Union parties. Then you also had the Green Party, this environmentalist party that is left-wing, even beyond environmentalism. So kind of pro-immigration, wanting to welcome more migrants to Germany. They, of course, immediately clashed with the Christian Social Union that wants less immigrants and to do more to discourage migrants from arriving. And then you had the Free Democrats that are in a lot of ways the polar opposites of the Greens. You know, these are the pro-business, get rid of environmental regulation, save the German car industry, cheap electricity rather than, you know, tariffs and green electricity. And these were the ones that she was trying to get together into a coalition. Then, you know, after a lot of different people leaking different news, putting comments to the papers that things weren't going well, that the talks were very acrimonious, the Free Democrats, well, Angela Merkel, first of all, Angela Merkel put in a post a deadline that she said we're going to get the preliminary negotiations finished by last Friday. That deadline came and went. They kept the talks going throughout the weekend. And then finally, Sunday evening, the Free Democrats just said, look, this isn't working. Even if we do come up with some kind of agreement, it's going to be a bad government. It's better to have no government at all than a bad government.
Okay. So everything breaks down. And the only ones on the outside going into this, as you mentioned, the Liberal Party, that she was in an alliance with them just even previous to the mm-hmm. most recent elections.
That's right.
And then the only other one is the AfD. Is that right? Or
well, there's also the Left Party, which okay. is the kind of the successor party to the East German Communist Party. So they're radical left.
So there's just no options, basically.
Right. And then even actually in the last 10, 15 minutes or so, the Social Democrats came out again and said, we're still not going to work with Angela Merkel, even after this coalition talks have collapsed. So, yeah, there are no more coalition options left, really.
Okay. So going forward, and this is really what your article at thetrumpet.com is largely about, you lay out I think four different scenarios of what could happen. Maybe you could just summarize each of these possibilities in the road ahead.
So one is fresh elections. And I think a lot of people are looking at this as well, perhaps the most likely outcome. So under this, basically Merkel concludes we can't form a government. We have to have another vote. This process would take a little over 2 months. I think it's she can't call fresh elections for another 2 or 3 weeks. That process takes some time. And then when she calls them, it's a 60-day election campaign. Now, yeah, in a lot of ways, that's the most straightforward to organize. But at the same time, everyone kind of knows, well, if they do that, they're probably going to emerge from those fresh elections in either exactly the same position that they are now or an even worse position. Nothing's really changed. If anything, support for Angela Merkel's political party and the Social Democrats as well have both decreased.
Mm-hmm.
And support for parties like the Alternative for Deutschland, that fringe party on the right that no one wants to work with, have increased. So if she held fresh elections, the elections, I guess, would probably end up being January, maybe February, and they'd come of that and they'd still be the same position. Social Democrats and Christian Union parties won't work together. Jamaican Coalition won't work. They've just got nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first option. Another option would be for Angela Merkel to try and form... Oh, and by the way, the fresh elections option never happened before in German post-war history. So that would be breaking brand new ground in this country that really values stability. But the other option,
just before you go, the one point you make in the article is that this is the first time they even tried to bring four parties together. So then calling for a new election, that's never been done. And going back to what Brad McDonald said last year, I think the contrast that he brings out in the article between Germany in the Weimar Republic days as compared to coming out of World War II, which he says in his article that the political system that was basically set up was to prevent this sort of thing from happening, to give them stable leadership. And now you see some of the same things that were going on back in the 1920s and 30s happening today.
Exactly. And that's actually why it's a bit of a convoluted process to call fresh elections. Why there's this 2-week waiting period and then 60 days is because the post-war constitution was designed to make it hard to call fresh elections. They kind of almost had to find it's almost like a loophole in the constitution where they appoint a temporary chancellor and then that person calls fresh elections. So yeah, this is not something that the original designers of the modern German state wanted to be happening.
Okay. And then because they could lose more support, it seems like, judging by your article, that even though it's a possibility, it seems less likely at this stage.
Well, I don't know. I think they're just really stuck. Because the other option I've heard, or the other kind of big option, is a minority government. And I've seen a few places just saying, well, this is so unstable it couldn't happen. And this is also something that's never happened in Germany's post-war history. So what would happen here is Angela Merkel, or maybe with, say, the Green Party's help, would govern without a majority. And so she would just every time there was a new law, she'd have to try and get case by case support for each individual law. So you'd have basically the equivalent of these last coalition negotiations over every single piece of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And because people have been looking at that and saying, well, look, this is a crisis moment for Europe. And this would just gridlock Germany. And it probably wouldn't last very long anyway. These type of governments tend to fall apart because all it takes is the majority to have a vote of no confidence and it falls apart and the government doesn't have a majority to block that.
Right.
So that's a pretty terrible option. But then those are the only two options facing. Now, the other possibility that might open up a few more things is if Angela Merkel resigns. And like those headlines you were quoting, a lot of people are talking about that being a serious possibility. Die Welt did a poll. It was ahead of what we've seen going on now. And their poll concluded that 2/3 would believe that Angela Merkel should step down if her coalition negotiations have failed. Those have now failed. So that implies about 2/3 of Germans think that she should step down.
Right. So what happens then? How is that different from just her calling for fresh elections? Like if she steps down, what does that trigger?
Well, the other options remain the same. But first of all, maybe that opens up some more options with coalition negotiations. People have speculated that maybe if Angela Merkel goes and you have someone else, that the Social Democrats might change their position.
Okay.
Potentially, they could even restart the Jamaica coalition talks with a different, different person in charge might have different policies. And then even going into the election, the last election was the public's verdict on Angela Merkel. if they go into the next election with exactly the same leader, probably the same thing's going to happen. But if they get a new leader at the head, I think that maybe they could go in there hoping to win more votes and hoping to actually have enough to get a more stable coalition. So it could be a way for them to try and win more votes in the upcoming election if they went down that route as well.
Okay. Well, we appreciate that update. And maybe here at the close of this segment, I'll open it up for you to just summarize some of the things that we have said at thetrumpet.com over the years. I know in the article there at the end, you refer to some previous articles, or we have a soundbite here from my father that we'll play here in just a second. But is there anything else that you want to steer our listeners to?
Well, it'd mostly be that. I mean, we did do a big feature on this in our last Trumpet print magazine. We kind of held the front page and the first section of there to make sure that we could cover the latest from the German elections in that magazine. We put Germany on the front cover, and we kind of did, but we tried to make sure we went in depth and to take our readers through those prophecies, just to show in detail how what you're seeing in Germany right now so closely matches the conditions that the Bible describes for a German leader growing within Europe. I think the only other angle, apart from that one that I think you're about to get into with that, is just also something that some of Mr. McDonald's articles have talked about over the last few years, is that this instability is also just a symptom of some much deeper problems in Germany. And you got the way some commentators kind of talked about this, if they could just find the perfect compromise, everything would be great within Germany. But you know, this gridlock is a result of an election where people voted for fringe parties, people abandoned main political parties in droves. There's a deep dissatisfaction in Germany. A lot of people very unhappy in a way that just goes beyond maybe normal politics or the typical division. And so what we're seeing is a reflection of that. And that deep dissatisfaction is always going to have major results. And so that's what the Bible tells us. It paints out a very clear picture of what will happen to lead to this leader. But if you just take a sober look at what's going on in Germany, I think you could see the same conditions building.
Well, as our regular listeners are well aware of, the prophecy in Daniel 8, we've been trumpeting this prophecy for some time now. The Bible talks about this strong man to come out of the heart of Europe. He says in Daniel 8, Daniel 11, that he's going to come in by flatteries. And in his article, Richard refers back to this 2009 program by my father, where he talks about a strong man potentially taking advantage of an unstable political process. This is from 2009.
Now, he's not going to come in by, let's say, a democratic process. He's going to come in and use flatteries and sort of tweak the democratic process, it says here, something like that, and perhaps take advantage of a weak coalition, but he's going to come in by flatteries.
That's my father referring to Daniel 8 and Daniel 11. And also back in 2002, in an article, he said that this Daniel 8 man doesn't come to power the honorable way by being voted into office. He takes it dishonorably. He will work behind the scenes, it says, and come to power by flatteries, not votes. So the Bible's very specific. And so, again, there may be some things, and Richard lays out some different scenarios there. We may not know all of the details specifically, but we certainly know enough to understand how this man rises to power. And I just want to conclude the segment by switching gears a little bit, but really it ties in, because if you remember back even before the Philadelphia Church of God, back in Herbert Armstrong's days, Mr. Armstrong was pointing to an economic crisis that would also bring together these 10 kings in Europe. There's been quite a bit in the news of late. Both sides, I guess. I saw two, I guess, are both sides just this weekend. You had one article, Goldman Sachs, saying that if you thought 2017 was surprisingly good, just wait for 2018. There's those that believe the economy, even the president himself in the United States, has been trumpeting the surging stock market and other such positive signs. But as we well know, it's not going to last. And Niall Ferguson over here in the UK, he had a column just yesterday at the Times talking about the financial red lights that are flashing again. And in this piece, he talks about the warning that he was sounding back in 2006 and 2007, saying that, or observing, as he says in his piece, that interest rate increases by the Fed Reserve would sooner or later have an effect on heavily indebted American households. And he says further on in his article, by the autumn of 2007, it was becoming apparent to professionals, if not to the public, that something was indeed amiss. But still, people underestimated the danger. He says, I argued that we confronted a more toxic cocktail than many investors still want to believe. He says, finally, in December of 2007, I predicted a great dying of financial institutions as a man-made disaster. The subprime mortgage crisis works its way through the global financial system. The point that he makes is that this was not going to be a crisis for America alone, but rather a worldwide crisis. And, of course, that's what happened there at the end of 2008. And many think now, well, we've recovered from that and we're moving on. But the signs are there, as he brings out in his piece, the financial red lights, as he puts it. So, as I say, it brings to mind what Mr. Armstrong said many, many years ago. This takes us back to the 1980s and what he said about the economic crisis. Clip two.
And in the days of these kings, those toes which represent a nation to be formed, as I told you, in Europe when they go together. Now they're trying to form that now, and this economic crisis may be the thing that'll plunge them into it.
It's a mixture of iron and clay, Daniel Tu says. So it's never something that just comes together easily. It's an unusual mixture, an unsteady mixture in many ways. But it will come together, and as he said there, the economic crisis is going to contribute to, like Richard just brought out earlier, I mean, you've got all these other problems across Europe. The last thing that Europe needs, the way they're looking at it, the last thing that Europe needs is for Germany to be in crisis politically, because they're all looking to Germany to lead. And so it's amazing how the stage is being set for this strong man to appear. You're listening to Stephen Fleury along with Richard Palmer in this segment. This is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. When we come back, we will once again review the new Churchill movie. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong described Germany's devastating destruction in 1944 and 1945 as one of the worst beatings ever administered to any nation. Western leaders from both sides of the Atlantic assured our peoples that a demoralized Germany would never again be able to disturb the peace of the world. But while Washington and London were promising that German militarism would never again be able to strike, Herbert Armstrong was warning the world of one final resurrection of a German-led Holy Roman Empire. Only a very few listened. Mr. Armstrong said German industry and the German people's willpower and determination to work, produce, and organize was the very heart and lifeblood of all Europe.
The nations of Europe want to unite. They just don't know how to do it.
He said the prostrate body of Europe could not come back without the leadership of a revived and vigorous Germany.
And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
The world is witnessing history repeat itself one more time. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire for more on this important subject. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
We have before us many, many long months of struggle and suffering. Even though many old and famous states have fallen into the grip of the Nazi rule, we shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. For without victory, there can be no survival.
That's a little snippet from the trailer to the new Winston Churchill movie, Darkest Hour. And, well, you heard it. You can see why we were pretty excited on September 15th. In fact, or I guess it was the 13th now. In fact, as I remember in the lead up to that that program, I got an email from Richard Palmer, who said that judging by all the bad reviews coming in from the left-wing media, that this movie probably is pretty good. So I came on the air, Richard, and staked my journalistic integrity on that email, perhaps even my career as a broadcaster. I put it all on the line, and now the right-wing reviews are coming in, and in this case, it wasn't so good. Tell me why we got it wrong on September 13th.
Wow, that's quite the apology I've got to make here. Well, it's it certainly did look promising. Even those speeches with that music behind it is by itself sounds pretty awesome. But the National Review has just this excellent article. We've put it up on the headlines section on our website, Darkest Hour Dishonors Winston Churchill's Memory, where his withering final line, for the sake of a good yarn, it mistakes a lion for a jellyfish. The author talks about just this it was the same thing we saw in that Lincoln biography a few years ago. I was really excited for that. At the time, I didn't really know a huge amount about Abraham Lincoln. I saw there was this movie about it. I don't think I ended up going and seeing it because, again, it takes a great leader of the past and makes him wavery and wishy-washy, and it kind of does the same thing according to this review to Winston Churchill, that he gives this epic speech at the end of the movie, but throughout a good chunk of it he's ready to to surrender to Adolf Hitler, to negotiate with Adolf Hitler. He's not sure what to do, and as this article brings out, that's just a gross distortion of the truth.
Yeah, it says here, this is as he says, the National Review. In Darkest Hour, which is set across May and June of 1940, the English director Joe Wright and his star Gary Oldman conspire to create a somewhat comical, quavering, and very human prime minister. In dramatic terms, it's an engaging picture, and Oldman is terrifically appealing. But if you're looking for indecision and angst, the person of Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill is a curious place to declare you found it. I mean, if you're going to try to make a story about someone who's indecisive, they, of all people, they go to Winston Churchill. And then this review, I forget who wrote it exactly, but he goes on to bring out how that these crucial days, I mean, as the article says, at Britain's darkest hour, as the title of the movie says, they show Churchill kind of waffling and going back and forth. You brought down the book with you. What's the title of it again?
5 Days in London, May 1940, by John Lukacs.
And that's something that my father's also quoted from, I believe, on the Key of David television program.
I think so. I think it might be also in that Winston Churchill, The Watchman. But right. I know he certainly made a few quotes.
Yeah,
quotes from it.
And what you read it, I know, a while back. But what stands out to you in comparison to what this the last bit of this film evidently shows?
Yeah, it's just a great little book. And John Lukacs begins by just really setting what was at stake here. It does sound like the movie gets this bit right, where he just talks about how, you know, these were the days where the war was won and lost. And right now we kind of look at it like it was inevitable that Adolf Hitler would lose World War II, because that is what happened. But he really makes the case at the start that if things had gone a bit different, if Churchill had wavered, then this would have been then Adolf Hitler could well have won. That he says that the danger not only to Britain but to the world was greater than deep and deeper than most people still think. And so this whole book is just about a kind of almost like a 5-day long verbal battle between Winston Churchill on the one hand, who did not want to compromise with Adolf Hitler, and Lord Halifax, the foreign minister and just a key member of the Conservative Party, a very influential figure, who wanted to start peace negotiations with Mussolini to try and come up with some kind of compromise with Hitler. And it was a perilous time for Churchill. He was a new prime minister. He goes through some of the opinion polls and things in this book, and now we see Churchill as this great man. That's not how he was seen by a lot of people back then. He did definitely have supporters, but it's not the same vision that we have today. And he talks about had Halifax resigned from the cabinet, had Chamberlain followed him, it would have quite possibly brought down Churchill's premiership. He would have had to resign. Everything could have gone incredibly differently. So he had to handle this very carefully. On the one hand, he did not want to, he knew he could not compromise with Hitler. On the other hand, he knew that he couldn't force Lord Halifax and Chamberlain to resign. So he had to tread incredibly carefully over these 5 days. But what really comes across is his resolution. And it's just this whole book is just peppered with almost asides. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not even he's drawing much attention to it, where he says, we are never going to surrender. I mean, one just quick anecdote I found quickly that I thought was very revealing was Halifax was talking about the possibility of peace with Hitler, and it said that Churchill reacted with fury. He said that it was high treason, and Halifax was quite insulted by this. He wrote a letter to Churchill afterwards and said, it may have been a silly idea, it may have been a foolish idea of mine, but please don't accuse me of treason. And Churchill wrote back and he apologized, but he said, I had a spasm of fear. I'm sorry if I offended. It was a very deadly thought in this atmosphere of frustration. Mm-hmm. So all of, throughout this time period, to him, surrender wasn't a possibility that he was vacillating backwards and forwards. He saw it as a very dangerous thought.
Right. Yeah, and his most famous statement during that dark period, if not during, his entire life, he said, if this Long Island story of ours is to end at last, let it end only when each one of us lies choking in his own blood upon the ground. And as this reviewer at National Review brings out, that's not the kind of statement you make if you're just going back and forth. And the other thing he talks about, as far as the movie's interpretation of those events, is that he was going to this meeting where he was going to address his cabinet, and what was it? The car got stalled, and he had to go and travel by the tube. And he's talking to your, average Londoner who's trying to, get him to really get that fighting spirit that that Britain needed. Pretty amazing. As Richard brought out, I think there's probably some good parts to this movie, but maybe we ought to get out of the reviewing business and just wait until these movies come out. We talked about, I mentioned last week, just as an aside here, that we've got a few people reading through Manchester's biographies on Churchill. And so as part of our reading group, we've been just scouring the internet for possible movies that we could see to, and they're just hard to find. They're hard to find some good pictures because, as you said, even with respect to Lincoln, and like the reviewer at National Review says, there every effort or every attempt in the modern day era of filmmaking is to really shrink these towering figures of history. And even when you've got a pretty good picture, you still see elements of trying to diminish just how great some of these great figures of history have been. Well, I want to thank Richard for staying over a little bit longer today to clear up the Good review, bad review on The Darkest Hour. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Perhaps no hour in Britain's history was darker than that preceding World War II. Nazi Germany was arming. Nations in Europe were being conquered, their borders redrawn. Britain, the nation that once ruled one quarter of the earth, teetered on the edge of survival. Many leaders in Britain feared war. They wanted to disarm. They spoke of peace as Europe sank deeper into the pit of war. This dark hour may have been Britain's last, were it not for one man. This man stood alone in the face of adversity at home and abroad. He rose to the occasion when his nation needed him most. He vowed that Britain would never surrender when confronted by forces of evil. Winston Churchill took Britain's most important job during Britain's darkest hour. He did what others were afraid to do. Some doubted his methods, but the results speak for themselves. Churchill led Britain from the precipice of ignominious defeat and possible death to what became one of the nation's brightest hours. What was it that made Winston Churchill so different from other leaders of his time? Surely now, more than ever, this world needs another Winston Churchill. Our booklet, Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman, explains what made this man such a great leader. We would like to offer this booklet to you free of charge. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG, 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Over the weekend, we heard a great message by Brad McDonald, who sometimes fills in for me here on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. He talked about lessons from the former prophets, a book that he's going through, along with his spokesman club members here in the UK. It's a book my father wrote a few years ago. Just wonderful, practical instruction throughout this this book, and Mr. McDonald just brought out a few of the lessons that you can take away from that. My wife since reminded me of a statement my father makes right at the outset of the book, where he says, "We have to learn about these spiritual warriors of the past. We need to learn about Joshua and Samuel and David." I kind of paraphrased this at the top of the show. But then my father later says we should understand why Saul failed, even though he had such a great opportunity. He had such a great opportunity before him. And yet, why did he fail? What was the problem? What tripped him up? Here he was king. I mean, he was a king over Israel. And yet, just to bring up something else I was reading recently, Ryan Malone had an article at the PCOG website. This is our church website. The Creator of Thrones was one section that stood out to me. And he cites a few verses, Colossians 1, 16 and 17, about how that God is the one who creates thrones or dominions. There's a verse in Daniel 2 and verse 21 that says, God removes kings and sets up kings. It's God who reigns supreme. It's God. I mean, this is Satan's world for sure, and God does have a hands-off policy for 6,000 years. We've been cut off from God. But at the same time, I mean, if you understand Bible history, if you know anything about the God of this universe, for him to remove a king and to set up another, that's nothing for God to do. That's nothing for God to take care of. To transfer kingly power from one to another, This is not unusual. In fact, and Ryan Malone brings this out in his article, if you go back to a time when Israel, they had God as their king. But then the people went to the prophet Samuel and demanded another king. And Samuel, of course, if you know the history, he was very upset by this development. He knew that by demanding for a human king like the nations around them, that Israel was in fact rejecting God as their king. Well, God counseled Samuel and said, all right, we'll set up a king for the people, but you just be steadfast in your honor and worship of me. 1 Samuel chapter 9. Notice what this has to say about this often overlooked history. 1 Samuel 9 and verse 1, it says, now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, it says. Well, there's lots of sons mentioned, it says later. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a choice young man and a goodly. It says, and there was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he, for his shoulders and upward, he was higher than any of the people from his shoulders and upward. I mean, he was a tall, impressive, good-looking man of strength and power coming from a wealthy and influential family. He was head and shoulders above the crowd, literally. And the name Saul, if you look into it, it means asked for. The people asked for a king, and God gave them one. He was the people's choice. He was exactly what Israel was looking for, strong and powerful, just like so many of the kings around Israel or in the nations around Israel. Yet at the same time, God didn't just select a corrupt individual in order to teach Israel a lesson. Early on, and this is brought out in the scriptural account, early on, this tall, impressive, powerful man, he had everything going for him. He was right. His heart was right before God. In fact, he had every possible chance to do it right, to be a successful king, to be a powerful instrument in the hand of God. Verse 3, here in 1 Samuel 9, it says, and the asses of Kish, Saul's father, were lost, and Kish said to Saul, his son, take now one of the servants with you, and arise, and go seek the asses, it says. And he passed through Mount Ephraim, and passed through the land of Shalisha, it says, but they found them not. And then they passed through the land of Shalem, and there they were not. And he passed through the land of the Benjamites, but they found them not. It says, and when they were come to the land of Zuph, Saul said to his servant that was with him, come and let us return, lest my father leave, caring for the asses, it says, and take thought for us. So this was the land that Saul had come from originally, and God was, he was working all of this out in order to show Samuel and the nation that he had chosen Saul to be king. Verse 6 says, and he said to him, behold now, there is in this city a man of God, and he is an honorable man. All that he says, comes surely to pass. Now let us go there. Peradventure, he can show us our way that we should go. So as I say, God was setting all of this up, and one of Saul's servants here suggests that they seek Samuel, the prophet Samuel, for guidance. Verse 7, and it says, then said Saul to his servant, but behold, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread is spent in our vessels, and there's not a present to bring the man of God. What have we? And the servant answered Saul again and said, behold, I have here at hand the fourth part of a shekel of silver. That will I give the man of God to tell us our way. So they wanted to give him a gift to show their appreciation and support. Verse 15, further down, it says, now the Eternal had told Samuel in his ear a day before Saul came, saying, tomorrow about this time, I'll send you a man out of the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be captain over my people Israel, that he may save my people out of the hand of the Philistines. For I have looked upon my people, because their cry is come unto me. So God had communicated to both of these individuals to set up this meeting, and he told Samuel, look, I've selected a captain. I've selected a captain that's going to save God's people right out of the hands of the Philistines. God would do this through Saul. So again, when you just think on this from God's perspective, I mean, we know the history, we know what happened, we know the end of the story, but God, again, God didn't set a trap for Israel, and as I say, set up a guy who was corrupt from the beginning. He offered Saul this incredible opportunity to lead, to be a God-fearing leader. It's God who sets up kings or who removes kings, like it says over in Daniel 2, verse 17. And when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said unto him, behold, the man whom I spoke of you, or the man whom I spoke to you of, this same shall reign over my people. And then Saul drew near to Samuel in the gate and said, tell me, I pray you, where the seer's house is. And Samuel answered Saul and said, I am the seer. Go up before me unto the high place, for you shall eat with me today. And tomorrow I will let you go and will tell you all that is in your heart. And as for your asses that were lost 3 days ago, set not your mind on them, for they are found. And on whom is all the desire of Israel? Is it not on you and on all your father's house? And Saul answered and said, am I not a Benjamite, of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Wherefore then speak you so to me? I mean, he was overwhelmed at the thought of ruling Israel, at the prospect of being king over Israel. He couldn't believe that someone coming from the lowly tribe of Benjamin could ever rise to that level of leadership. But that's exactly what happened. Verse 22, it says, this is again 1 Samuel chapter 9, and Samuel took Saul and his servant and brought them into the parlor and made them sit in the chiefest place among them that were bidden, which were about 30 people. And Samuel said unto the cook, bring the portion which I gave you, of which I said unto you, set it by you. And the cook took up the shoulder and that which was upon it, and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, behold, that which is left, set it before you, and eat. For unto this time, it says, has it been kept for you, since I said, I have invited the people. So Saul did eat with Samuel that day. So he was given the chief seat here, and given this goodly portion, as the scripture brings out, this portion of the sacrifice. Samuel set up the sacrifice beforehand and invited all of these important people, these distinguished guests, and it was all in Saul's honor. Verse 25 says, and when they were come down from the high place into the city, Samuel communed with Saul upon the top of the house, and they arose early. And it came to pass about the spring of the day that Samuel called Saul to the top of the house, saying, up, that I may send you away. And Saul arose, and they went out, both of them, he and Samuel, abroad. And as they were going down to the end of the city, Samuel said to Saul, bid the servant pass on before us. And he passed on, but stood you still a while, that I may show you the word of God. So here is, again, God's prophet giving a lot of advice and counsel and direction to this young king, this new king, about how to rule God's people. And notice the next chapter. I mean, some of that's background information, I guess, that you could say. But look at verse 1 of 1 Samuel 10. It says, then Samuel took a vial of oil and poured it upon his head and kissed him and said, is it not because the Eternal has anointed you to be captain over his inheritance? So here is the anointing, and Samuel, or rather, yeah, he proceeds to give Saul these three signs to prove that God was with him. And you can read the following verses to see what Samuel got into, but we'll just cut to the chase here. Verse 6, and the Spirit of the Eternal will come upon you, and you shall prophesy with them, and shall be turned into another man. I mean, when God's Spirit comes upon you, you're going to become a new man. This is talking about conversion, something that's discussed throughout the Bible, the New Testament in particular, where Paul wrote about putting on the new man, this change of heart that happens when you're converted to God's truth. The Spirit of God will come upon you, Saul. And you'll be different. You'll be new. You'll be converted. And when other people see you, they're going to see someone who's different from the Saul that they once knew. Verse 9, here in 1 Samuel 10, it says, and it was so that when he had turned his back to go from Samuel, God gave him another heart. And all those signs came to pass that day. Again, read the whole chapter later when you have a chance to study through this passage. And look at these details. God gave him another heart. Another heart, as it says there in verse 9. A heart like his. David, we talk about King David having a heart like God's, as it says in Acts 13. But here is King Saul. As a converted man, a converted young man who had another heart. It wasn't like that old carnal heart that he had in the lead up to this point. He was converted to God's truth. Verse 10 says, and when they came there to the hill, behold, a company of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God came upon him, and he prophesied among them. And it came to pass when, notice this, when all that knew him before time saw him, that behold, he prophesied among the prophets. Then the people said one to another, what is this that has come into or unto the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets? I mean, what is he doing with these prophets? What's come upon him? Why is he so different? Well, he's always been impressive physically, and he's had some charisma and such. But now they were seeing another heart. They were seeing a man who was a lot different, someone that they could hardly recognize as the old Saul. Verse 7, just back up for a moment, it says, and let it be when these signs are come unto you, that you do as occasion serve you, for God is with you. And you shall go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I will come down unto you to offer burnt offerings and to sacrifice sacrifices of peace offerings. 7 days shall you tarry till I come to you and show you what you should do. So, well, that kind of, I guess, takes it in another direction that hopefully I can spend some more time on tomorrow. Saul, after a couple of years, I mean, he really ran into some troubles because of vanity and self-love. But as you can see from just a fairly quick study of 1 Samuel 9 and 10, it wasn't like that at the beginning. At the beginning, I mean, he was an example of true righteousness. He had a heart like God's. He had a heart that was submissive. He had an opportunity, like my father says in the Form of Prophets book. He had a tremendous opportunity right there in front of him to rule like God, to become perfect like God, to become perfect like our Father in heaven is perfect. That's really what it means, to be another man. That's what true conversion is all about, taking on the heart of God, like King David did later. It did start in so many different ways. It did start with King David, and there's a reason why it's called David's throne. And there's a reason why King David is going to be resurrected to rule with Jesus Christ. But still, you can go back even before King David came along and learn some valuable lessons from this other king, another king that God ended up removing. It's God who can set up or take down a king. It's God who can install or remove a king. It's God who sets up thrones. And when we have an opportunity to learn from God and to prepare for rule, I mean, that's something we want to take full advantage of, to rule along with Christ, as so many verses throughout the Bible bring out. Revelation 5:10, and there's several in Revelation chapter 2. Kings and priests, Jesus Christ is returning to this earth as King of kings, plural, and Lord of lords, plural. That's why we want to look into the book, the former prophets. That's why we want to look into the lives of these great men and women of the Bible and learn about these spiritual warriors of the past and learn about the successes of David and Samuel and also the failures. And in the case of Saul, to learn about why he failed, even though God had given him such a tremendous opportunity. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you again tomorrow.